in a world full of straight people. Aren't you glad there's WOW Presents Plus, the number one place in the world to see Drag Race? And so much more. Subscribe to WOW Presents Plus. Still only $4.99. Subscribe today as streamed on TV.
Start your engines and join me in the new mobile game, RuPaul's Drag Race Superstar. May the best superstar win. Available now.
Matt, we have a legitimate legend in the house, in Zoom, in his house.
That's right. That's right. In our it's Zoom. Big. I'll tell you, Michael Grassi never once expresses any interest in anything I'm doing on any podcast. Mm-hmm. When he heard that we were having this person, he's asked me every day this week when the interview is. It's only Tuesday, but it seems like he's asked me many times.
Okay, well, that's twice. It's still lot of times. You talk about a lot of times.
We're very excited is the point.
We're very excited. I mean, the man needs no introduction. Darren Hayes, welcome at last.
Thank you for having me. I've been stalking you, and I'm going to divulge the fact that I DM'd to get onto the podcast because I was like, why have I never been on this show? So here I am.
Is that honestly true?
True.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's wow. And there's no good reason. There's no good reason. Like, we communicate once in a blue moon, and like,
no, we
yeah,
do. No, I'm a big fan. I was just sitting around. You know what it's like when you're an aging pop star in between albums and projects, and you
don't actually know what that's like at all.
You do, Dave.
I only know the aging part. But
okay. Oh, you definitely don't know, Matt. But no, I'm a big fan of the show, and I just thought I want to come on and just shoot the shizzle.
Well, Dave has brought it up in the past, and I've leaned in and gotten really psyched for it. And then Dave needs an assistant, I think, is the real lesson here.
That's the absolute.
Do you know what it is too? I'm also kind of very naturally shy. So Dave has been very kind to me over the years. I think you've invited me over to your house sometimes.
I've
kind of gone, yes, I'll do that. And I treat you, Dave, the same way I treat someone like Gwyneth Paltrow. I treat anyone who is that I call famous the same way. I introduce myself, I tell them they're fantastic, and then I leave. So it's pretty much what I do. So yeah.
Wow. Okay. Well, that's extremely flattering, and we have treated you that same exact way. We've been like, oh, you should come on the show, and then for some reason we chicken out. But listen,
it was mostly Madonna actually, because Madonna's been touring.
Well, right. I saw that you just saw her.
Yeah, a lot.
Last month.
I know. And I'm thinking about flying to Texas to see her because I am that much of a fan.
Wow. And
I get it. What a show. Let's get into that. I mean, what are your highlights?
My highlights is that she's having fun. And I know, Dave, you go way back with Madonna, but, I have a couple of artists, I think, who are pivotal. And the reason that I even exist, you know, Michael Jackson was one of them. George Michael is one, and Madonna is the other one. I remember jogging as a 15-year-old because I saw Truth or Dare. And I remember thinking, oh, athleticism is something you need to have as a pop star. So that was way back then. And she didn't come to Australia until 1992. So the first tour, the Virgin Tour, this might have been how I knew I was gay. I invited a couple of boys around to my house, get your minds out of the gutter. And I popped on the Virgin Tour video cassette, and I wanted to do all the choreography from the show.
Yeah.
And what I love about this tour is she's referencing all of these things, even in the costumes. Like, I'm that much of a stan that I notice like the color palette of the costumes when the show opens. It's virtually like that Prince-inspired dress-you-up outfit that she's wearing in the Virgin Tour. Some of the choreography, it's kind of like watered down versions of things that she's done in other tours. And then there are the obvious things, you know, like the red bed from Truth or Dare or the Blonde Ambition tour. But yeah, I'm obsessed because she's happy. And I've seen her on tour when she wasn't happy. And that's hard, I think, as a fan to watch your idol just go through the motions.
Yeah. You know, when you said you invited a bunch of boys around to the house and said, get your mind out of the gutter, my mind exactly went to putting on the Virgin Tour and doing the choreography.
I love that. It's so great.
That is the specific gutter. Yeah. That all of our minds go to, I would imagine. It was a joyful show. I didn't know until after that there were so many of her kids in it. I didn't know that Mercy James was Mercy, and I didn't know that Queen Esther doing the duck walk,
I think we call it. Mm-hmm. That's what the kids call it. Yeah. The duck walk.
Uh-huh. And leaving it all on the dance floor was her daughter Esther. Also, I didn't know that person was like 13, which is.
Yeah, that's wild. Another thing. I got to say, her son also, David, like I saw it a couple of times. So I was very, very close to the cast. And man, that kid has stage presence. Like he really does. Like he obviously has a very good teacher. But he's the guy playing Prince in that moment in Like a Prayer. You know, he has the little veil on with the chains in front of his face, like the My Name is Prince video. He's pretty cool.
Yeah, it was an unbelievably satisfying show. Did you happen to read, I don't know if it was Cracked or Collider or one of those sites that I get, or maybe Stereo Gum or something, but there was an oral history of Madonna's appearance on Late Night with David Letterman from 94 or 95. Wow. Not the Sandra Bernhard one, but the one where she came back smoking the cigar and, you know, saying fuck left and right and all that kind of thing. It's a fascinating read.
I have to read it. No, I'm obsessed with that because, well, actually, maybe you can educate me on this because, and maybe the article does that, but I remember seeing it at the time and not getting it. And then years later, realizing that Dave was apparently supposed to be in on the joke and he kind of bailed.
Well,
is that true or no?
There was a kind of a pre-interview that took place, and there was sort of, you know, I mean, you know, in a roundabout way, kind of, I guess, in his position, the way that the thing is going to go. And what they had planned for her was she was going to play a series of jokes that he had made about her through the years and make him have to like explain them to her.
Right. Uh-huh.
So that's kind of what he was prepared for. And then she and Kevin O'Quan, her makeup artist, showed up.
Yes.
And they were super stoned and giggling away. And the writers tried to explain this bit to her that they had sort of cleared with her before. And she's like, I'm never going to remember that in a million years. And so then she just went out. And there's dissent over whether one of the producers said to her, just like, if you want to swear, you can swear, we'll bleep it, whatever. Which she took as license, which she heard as like, swear as much as you can, and that'll be your whole thing.
Sure.
Yeah. And poor David is not prepared. It wasn't a great night for either of them.
I gotta say, it's one of the most uncomfortable
except for ratings.
Yeah, ratings are great. It was so uncomfortable to watch. So uncomfortable.
Right. Yeah.
You've met her, right? You've interviewed her.
Briefly. I mean, I can't say that we've ever spoken.
Okay.
If we did, it was quick. But I never really got to interview her. She was one of those who was like, it's got to be Kurt. If she came in, it had to be Kurt. And if she couldn't get Kurt, then it would be John Norris. And if she couldn't get John Norris, or if it was going to be TRL, it had to be a Carson episode. There's no way I would have.
Wow. Well, I would have chosen you, Dave.
Well, I appreciate that.
Did you ever get to interview Darren at any point?
No, we didn't.
No.
But I just always loved Dave's interviews. And I think I read a lot of your stuff. And just, I think from a music historian point of view, I think I'm projecting onto you now, but you reminded me of the kind of kid that would have scoured the back of records when you were a kid, because that's kind of what 100%. I did. Yeah.
100%.
And I could tell that sort of from what you did on TV. But nice. I did meet Madonna.
Madonna?
Well, I met her in the strangest way. I have a book coming out, and I don't talk about this in the book, so I'll just talk about it here.
Bonus material.
It is. So I met her through Alec Kashishian, who Madonna fans know directed Truth or Dare. And it was in the strangest period because it was probably at the height of my fame. It was the Savage Garden period. And it was some pre-Oscars party that I think Gwyneth Paltrow was hosting. So this will all make sense. And everyone at the party, the joke at that party was that everyone was coming around to everyone and saying, hey, Matt Damon's having a private party afterwards and I can get you in. Do you want to come? So it was not that private because everyone got invited to the Matt Damon party. And it was for that film they did with Robin Williams that I should remember.
Good Will Hunting.
There you go. And I don't know how this happened, but I was standing at the bar and I was reciting lines from Truth or Dare. Like, do something else. Do my eyebrows. I don't care. Somebody sat some fat guy in the front row, gave me dirty looks all night. I swear to God. It was so depressing to me. And so anyway, this person tapped me on the shoulder and it was Alec. And he was like, are you doing lines from my movie? And I was like, are you Alec Kashishian? And he was like, how do you know how to pronounce my name? I'm like, because you're Alec Kashishian and I'm a Madonna fan and blah, 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 blah. So we sort of became friends, and which blew my mind. So in the late 90s, early 2000s, Alec and I were friends. And then this sounds really creepy, but it isn't. I was sort of set up with Christopher on a date, which just went terribly wrong. I think he would admit that as well. Just, just didn't happen.
Okay. We'll get deeper into that.
I got a couple questions there, but continue.
But what I was so proud about myself is I'm really not a star effer, right? So here was this kid who was huge. I'm not a star fucker and I'm huge. I'm a huge Madonna fan. And I think Alec was so used to people wanting access to Madonna or maybe him dangling Madonna in front of them. And there were opportunities with Alec where he would say like, hey, come to the south of France on blah, blah, blah's boat. We're doing this. Now, if you know me, that's the last thing in the world I would ever do anyway. It wouldn't matter who it was. I'm not going on someone's boat. Okay. Just, it's not going to happen, especially post Me Too, or pre Me Too. So I was always saying no to these invitations to meet Madonna. And a similar thing with Christopher, it was because Ingrid Chavez was managing Billy. Oh gosh. Kiss the Rain, Billy.
Oh, Billy Myers.
Billy Myers. And Billy was supporting us on tour. And this one night I get a phone call from Tommy Mottola and he says, I hear you do Ray of Light in your show. And I was like, no, I don't. And he says, well, Billy Myers says you've been doing it in soundcheck. And I said, well, yeah. I mean, he's like, well, Madonna's coming to the fucking show, so you do the fucking song in your show. I was like, yes, I do. So I hung up the phone.
Wow.
So Madonna comes to the show. I think it was at the Beacon Theater in New York. I'm dying. She comes late. She comes dressed as Madonna from the her Frozen video outfit. So she has black dyed hair. Everyone sees her walk in. I just about stop singing when she sits down. She waits until the point in the show when I sing Ray of Light. And then she stands up and leaves.
Oh my God.
Oh.
Now years go past. Now things didn't really work out with Christopher. Alec and I had a connection. That never really worked out. He was never that pleased with me. We stopped speaking. I eventually got married to him, you know, my husband. I'm living in London. This story is going somewhere. I had this mutual friend called David Collins, who has now sadly passed away. He was a famous interior designer. And he designed hotels, but also Madonna's home. And I met him at an Elton John function once. And he knew that I hated famous things and celebrity things. And so he said, Darren, come over tonight for a dinner party. I was like, what do you mean? What do you mean dinner party? He's like, it's simple. It's nothing. It's like 16 people. It's just a simple dinner party. Gwyneth and Chris are going to be there. And I just went, okay, I'm not coming. There's no way. Like, I can't do this. He's like, no, please come. Just come. Okay. If you don't feel comfortable, just come afterwards. Just come for a drink. I was like, okay, I'll come for a drink. I turn up to this place. A butler answers the door. I hear the chiming of like fancy crystal and stuff. I'm wearing jeans and a t-shirt. And then David Collins pops his head out. He's wearing a velvet Tom Ford like tuxedo. He looks stunning. He's like, Darren, oh my God, hi, come on in. So I'm dying. And then next thing happens. It's all in slow motion. I walk in. I see Alec, who is not very pleased with me because I don't know, maybe because I chose somebody else. I don't know. But he sees me and I go, and in slow motion, I'm like, hi, Alex, this is my husband. And then I get sort of thrown into this room and it's Madonna's birthday party.
Oh, it's my God.
16 people. She's just fallen off that horse after the Confessions tour. She's dressed with the corn rose, like the whole 70s look from Confessions. And David says, Darren, you know Madonna? And I say, we've never met, actually. And she says, I remember you. And she tells the story I just told you about the Beacon Theater. And I just think you're in the face of the, I mean, she is a black hole of energy, right? You're in the face of this energy. How do you withstand that? So I just said to her, that's true, but you left during my performance and you never told me what you thought of it. And then she said, oh, I liked it. I thought it was really good, actually. All of the air just left my lungs and I just sat down at this table. She proceeded to be incredibly charming. She ordered everyone in the room to tell jokes. It's like, you tell a joke, you tell a joke, whatever. And everyone just obeyed her because it was Madonna. And then—
Did you have a joke at the ready?
Oh, I did not. I was terrified because Alec had sat next to her and then started whispering in her ear. So he was now saying to her, this is the guy, blah, 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 blah. Oh, and I have no idea what she told him, but it was like, just say, I don't know, an ex came, you run into an ex. I was in a fat period, so I was not ready to meet someone and look good. You know, when you run into a potential ex, you want to look incredible. I didn't look good, right? I look, And so she's looking at me going, And then they have to go upstairs to have a chat. Leave the dinner and I'm just sitting there with my husband going, I think she's talking to him. I think she's like saying everything's going to be okay or you're fine or whatever, because our kind of disconnection was sort of painful. It was a very painful disconnection between me and Alec. And we sat there forever and she didn't come back downstairs. So we left. And then when we left, Orlando Bloom arrived. I mean, these are all the famous people I've ever known in one party and all the names I'll ever drop. And he said, how's the party? And as a joke, I went, ah, it's a bit shit. And he went, oh, really? And then we left and that was it. And that was my Madonna story. She was fabulous. And who knows what Alex said about me? I have no idea. Yeah.
Wow. What I love about it is obviously that she remembered you from the first meeting, but that this feels like a trilogy. Like it's left on a bit of a cliffhanger. Like you have unfinished business and you will meet again.
My unfinished business is I'm just such a fan. I love her. And it was, I resisted meeting her because of that idiom, you know, that fear of meeting your heroes. But to me, she completely lived up to it. She was an absolute star. I could see that hunger in her eyes, even in a room of people that she knew, that she needed everyone in that room to adore her. And we did. You couldn't not. It was just like falling into God. And I kind of understood it. You know, we've all met people of varying degrees of fame, I think, at this point in our lives. And maybe Bono is close. Bono's got this godlike presence. Maybe there's something, he's more like the Pope though. But Madonna's like a Pope you want to fuck. There's just something about her that just, oh, you would do. And she lived up to it. It was incredible.
Oh my God. Well, here to tell his side of the story is our special surprise guest, Alec Kashishian. No. Did you see U2 at the Sphere?
I did. So Willie Williams, who helped create that show or directs that show, he's one of my best friends. He's done every show that I've ever done, from when I was incredibly successful all the way down to last year. I played at the, where did I play in LA? Some theater where Madonna did her Madame X residency. I did one show in a theater in LA, but I've known him since 1996 because I wrote him a fan letter and just said, dear Mr. Williams, you know, I understand, you know, show gags and this and that. And I was obsessed with Zoo TV. I thought that was just he reinvented the rock show. Yes. So yes. And I'm interested to see what you think about it, because I think it's destroyed live shows now, because where do we go from here is my opinion of it.
Yeah, it was satisfying in every single way. They were exactly the right band to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they left a million hit songs on the table, right?
Yeah.
It was this incredibly riveting 2 hours. I do feel like the next two residencies there are Phish and Dead Company. And if there is not already a bummer tent in the sphere, there's going to need to be, because it's going to be a lot of people in their 50s who are going to want to, you know, kick their experience up a notch with some of the new products that are now legal and available. And they're not going to be, their bodies won't be ready for them. And the visuals that you are surrounded by are so intense and so immersive.
Yes.
I feel like the freakout potential is going to be very high. But it was truly like, it was like, I kept having to remind myself to look at the band.
Right.
You know?
There was a moment in the show where I felt this for him too, because here's a secret in case you don't know it. Every performer is petrified, and we're always absolutely scared to death that we'll lose your attention and that you will realize that we're really not cool. You know, Bono has a great quote that the stage is but a platform shoe, and everything is designed to just kind of make you feel a little bit cooler. And you have to own that. Like when you walk on stage, that's the difference between being in a covers band and then becoming a pop star, is that there is this precipice that you leap over one day where essentially you just piss on every corner of the stage. And there's a way to do it as well. Like when you first emerge, you can't just blow your wad. Madonna is a queen of this, you know, where, you know, an entrance is so important. Michael Jackson was incredible at it, you know, and that he could, you know, I remember during the Bad tour, you know, he would arrive and it was a staircase from within the center of the stage. And then he would just stand there. And that was just a moment. Now, 100 other things could happen. There was no video back then in the 80s, but that was the most arresting and incredible moment, because he had the audacity to believe that he could hold your attention just to do that. But I saw just a flicker of fear in Bono's eyes during the sphere, because I saw the moment when he sees that we're not looking at him anymore.
Yeah.
We're looking at the thing.
Yeah.
And that is scary as a performer, because you just think, but it's me. It's my right. voice. Yeah. I speak the words of angels, and you live off my every breath, you know? And if artists don't admit this, they're lying. That's what you need that. You need the audience to just be feeding off you. And all of those other things, they're just special effects to help drive home that point, you know, that illusion that you are somehow not of this earth. You know, that's what a yeah. pop star is, this creation that is just not of this earth, you know. And the sphere at one point is more impressive than any pop star at some point.
Right. But he's still the seed from which it all like blooms, right? Like it's still his voice. Even if you're not maybe looking at him, you're still, the thing that you are in awe of is like comes from what he has created.
Totally.
I don't know why I'm giving Bono a like a pep talk.
No, you should.
He doesn't need one, but
no, it's because it's true, because I think well, I can tell you right up until opening night, you know, what I love about them as a creative force is they question everything and they never take anything for granted. And you're right. To me, the best part of that show actually was they turned the screen off, and I think it was during, maybe they did this every night, but when they did All I Want Is You.
Yes.
And right. And just the power of how good that song was. And you mentioned this before, but that show existed essentially as a concept album. So they weren't even playing hits until the very, very end of the set list.
Yeah.
So for the show to stand up, like you said, with him, I mean, it begins with him rotating on a, you know, the spiral of a record player, which is just mind blowing.
Yeah.
You know, incredible.
Loved it. Loved it. You mentioned Michael Jackson just coming out and standing. His mm-hmm. Super Bowl halftime show, mm-hmm. when he finally appears on stage, mm-hmm. it stops and he's just standing there and people are clapping for him for 3 minutes.
Wow.
And when you do a Super Bowl halftime show, you get 12 minutes. So wow. A quarter of his halftime show is literally him not doing anything and people just flipping out. And he knew, and they knew that it would never...
Wow.
If they just left it there, people would just keep applauding, and they did.
He's sizzling. I love the way that he used to
sizzling.
Call that.
Sizzling.
I'm sizzling. I'm sizzling.
Oh, my God. What are you listening to now? What's in your rotation now?
Oh, man. I mean, everyone's obviously listening to the new Beyonce record.
Of course. What are your tracks?
Oh, God. I don't know them
the
off
new
by
Zodiac.
Heart. Yeah. Oh, God. I mean, the previous record was so great and that tour was incredible. I don't know the tracks off by heart yet, so I sound like okay. Donald Trump pretending that I read the Bible.
Yeah, that's fine.
I love the opening. What I like is the attention to detail. Like recently I just found out that I didn't even know why Paul wrote Blackbird, why Paul McCartney wrote Blackbird.
Yeah, I didn't either until this.
Right. And I love the attention to detail in terms of there are little things on that record, like her clicking her, you know, press-ons. Uh-huh. I'm doing this motion of that you can't hear, mm-hmm. but her clicking her fingernails together as a rhythmic device because she got that from Dolly Parton, or uh-huh. The fact that she has four or five voices on Blackbird because that represented those four or five women who were just treated so horribly, you know, by racist white people back in the day. Every decision I was listening to, is it 16 Carriages?
Uh-huh.
Right. And it makes me emotional because there's so many, it's such a great metaphor because I don't know what she means by it, but when I listen to that song, I hear that she's talking about what it feels like to be 21 or 22 and have 16 trucks of production. And you're sleeping you're being gently cradled to sleep in your bus, right? And you're traveling across the United States. And that analogy between being a first settler, but then also just being Black and being in America and the strive to still be emancipated from slavery. And she talks so much about the roots of her own lineage with her children, about her, that one song, I think it might be called Protector or Projector or something, mm-hmm. but, you know, she's talking about how there's this sort of history in the bloodline of who she is, even in her marriage, you know, the way she talks about her husband in terms of, in Jolene, which is just mm-hmm. like, I'll tell you why you're not going to come for my man, because I fucking raised him. Like yeah. I raised my children. Yeah. In fact, I trained that man. So it's like, bitch, step back. So to me, there's so much reclamation in the record, not only historically, in terms of just where roots and country music comes from, Black culture, but just her own journey as this 15-year-old kid who was a star and had no childhood, but watched these, to me, these carriages are trucks with production in them.
Yeah.
But maybe they're also families trying to make their way from one coast to another in this United States. Who knows?
Yeah. It's brilliant.
It is. It's very lyrical and important. And it isn't an easy first listen. And so when people, right. I judge people when they say they don't like it, it's usually white people. And I go, yeah. Okay, racist. No, but yeah. I really do judge people because I just think, well, you're not listening to the record and you don't know what it means and why she made it.
Yeah.
Let's do a little bit of the Darren Hayes biography. So you're married to a woman for, how old were you when you got married?
Oh my God. I was 23. We're still really good friends, by the way. Her name's Colby.
Colby.
And we very successfully managed to never be photographed together, which is pretty amazing. What's so funny about me being gay is that I hid the fact that I was married. So,
right.
Because you can imagine back then, even though Daniel and I wrote all of our songs and we couldn't dance for shit. We came out at a period when they were boy bands. And so it was sort of career suicide to have a girlfriend. And I was married. So first of all, the record company were pissed off that I was married. But psychologically, I think we can probably all guess now. I probably did that because I want to just lock that shit down because I knew, oh my God, I'm probably gay. Let me marry my best friend. But go ahead.
Well, that was my question. What?
Yeah.
I mean, you joked in the past about people around her kind of being like, you sure about this? Like, we're pretty sure. But what was your level of self-awareness?
Zero. In fact, just before I came to chat to you guys, I listened to Christopher Chamberlain, which broke my heart, talk about the fact that he was in his 70s. The actor, young folks can Google the name. You know, it wasn't until he was in his 70s that he was able to get over the level of self-hatred and internalized homophobia. Mine was so deeply ingrained in me that I didn't think I'd known a gay person. And of course, we all did, but I didn't think I knew anyone who was gay. And I'm 52 next month. I was, I'm just trying to think when the AIDS crisis really became mainstream. For me as a child was the death of Rock Hudson. It was when I was trying to teach my best friends how to do the dress you up dance from the beginning of the Virgin tour. And there were ads on television telling me that I would die from this virus. I didn't even really know how to have sex or what sex was. And I thought that AIDS was like a thought crime. So I thought if anyone knew that I had a crush on Stephen Baker, who was this boy in my class, that I would probably die. And I suffered so much that I wouldn't say I had a split personality, but I think that I was able to take that part of me and just not let it develop. And, you know, and then you do theater at school and you hang out with a lot of girls and, you know, I never ever made the first move. Now as a man, of course I do, but you know, as a just sweet faced little cherub that was the lead in school musicals, you know, I had girls, you know, interested in me. I came from a really violent home. My dad was a violent alcoholic and there was so much about my life that was supposed to be a secret that I had to hide, that I hid that from myself. So, you know, everyone was saying to my then fiance, like you just said, like, are you sure? Like, he's gay. Like, and I was so offended. I would be like, why does everybody think I'm gay? Like, what is this? Meanwhile, I vogued at my prom. Now, maybe there's some straight men that did that. But for me, back then, you know, I had the full pinstripe suit. I had the eyeglass. I vogued at my prom, you know.
Yeah. That's what I want to see photos of.
You'll see them soon. Yeah, they're coming.
Right. Oh, good.
Yeah.
Those are going to be the photos in the middle of the book.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I've been in the middle of scanning a bunch of stuff. It's kind of crazy. I used to have Slam, Madonna's dancer in the tour, who had the long dark hair. That was my way into like vicariously being gay because I'd be like, I just love the way he dances.
Right.
And I grew my hair long because, you know, he had long hair and, right, maybe 2 days before the prom, my father made me cut my hair off. But gosh. I would have looked like him a little bit, minus the abs. had that not happened.
Speaking of your iconic hair, can you tell a bit of the story about your? So after Savage Garden, you launch mm-hmm. your solo career. Mm-hmm. You're a huge record label.
Yeah.
Can you talk about the making of the video for Insatiable, which I think was your first big solo
million-dollar budget. Well, what's so stupid about all of this is that now when I look back on all of it, I mean, you can see from space that I'm at least androgynous. I mean, from the very first Savage Garden video, I mean, there was this war between the US label and the UK label because back then there was the whole Britpop thing. So every time we'd go to the UK, the UK would be like, we can't use these pictures of you. They need to be more avant-garde. And they would give me some severe bob. I looked a little bit like Monica Lewinsky sometimes. I don't know. You know, I was always wearing makeup. References were things like Duran Duran, Tears for Fears. Everything was new wave. You know, I painted my fingernails. I was dressed exclusively in Jean-Paul Gaultier mesh outfits. I mean, I couldn't be more homosexual. And they loved it. It was fine. It was absolutely fine until I came out to them.
Right.
So I came out to the label probably at the peak of Savage Garden. And it was a huge personal thing for me. You know, I came out to my managers. I remember running down a 747 after I had my first boyfriend. And I was just like, I'm gay. Like, and everyone's like, yeah, cool. We get it. It's great. We're really happy that you're happy. And I was like, it's just so great. And like, smell my boyfriend's t-shirt. You know, like I took my boyfriend's t-shirt on promo trips with me because he wore CK1. And I was just like, oh, you know, like I was so happy. Like my coming out was so happy. I didn't hide it from the press. I never had a red carpet girlfriend. I gave those super ambiguous answers to questions of like, what kind of girls do you like? I'd be like, well, you know, I'm into people. Or, you know, I never lied about who I was when I was in the band. What changed was the label started doing things like they would kiss me on the cheek. The big tough radio men would be like, hi, sweetheart. And they would feminize me and they would treat me like a woman. And when we made the video for Insatiable, I danced and I looked queer. You know, the feedback was, the unofficial feedback was, we can't release this because like, everyone's going to know he's gay. And it was horrifying. Like I had pictures of me put before, you know, I guess in the way a can of soup would be marketed, you know, it was put before rooms of people in test marketing. Which chin do you think is more masculine of this composite photo of this guy that we put together of Darren? You know, they would take pictures of me and they would choose which images they felt looked more masculine, which one looks more gay, which this, and they would tell me, they would say, this picture tested, women felt you looked too feminine in this picture. Therefore the president wants this to be the cover. Your curly hair looks too feminine. Anything feminine was just not allowed, disavowed. And that video was reshot as a result because I always joke about it being like a reverse Elvis Presley. You know, Elvis was censored because it was too sexual. Anything to do with me moving was too feminine, you know. And I didn't even have my hands in the air. Who knew? Yeah.
You know, you mentioned Daniel. I feel like I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't ask. I mean, Daniel, of course, is the other half of Savage Garden. But we know that you've never had a relationship and assume you still don't. But I guess my question is really less about him and more, you know, are you able today to value and celebrate that history for whatever it was?
Oh gosh. Yeah. And the songwriting, of course. Yeah. I mean, I've always had such reverence for our songwriting partnership and chemistry. And it's a bummer because I know that it's not the story that fans want to hear. I mean, I wish I could tell you a different story. You know, I love Stevie Nicks. I love Fleetwood Mac. I hated it. I hate it when either of them, like Lindsay or Stevie, rag on each other publicly. You don't want mom and dad to fight, you know?
Sarah Jessica Parker and Kip Cattrall, you know?
Right?
It's painful.
It's really painful. And what I've tried to do over the years is to really protect the legacy of those memories, because I'm a fan. Like I said, I'm the guy that's thinking about flying to Texas next week to see Madonna. I understand fandom because that's what I came from. I was a kid who saw the Bad tour, Michael Jackson's Bad tour. And that was the exact moment in time that I decided I would do this for a living, because I saw this alchemy happening. And I was less interested in what Michael was doing than I was in the effect that it had in the arena and the effect that it had on me as a young kid. I was so sad at that point in my life. I was so bullied and just so deeply sad in my life and my home life and everything. But for those 2 hours, I was transported. And that's what I wanted to do for a living. And so I'm always so careful about that when I speak about the band and about Daniel, because the songs don't belong to me. You know, they belong to people's mixtapes and, you know, to MySpace front pages and those really sacred moments in your life when you just have a window as a teenager when a song meant something to you. So it is a bummer, you know, and I talk about this in, I keep mentioning a book. I probably didn't tell you. I got a book deal with Penguin.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And but what was interesting about it is that it was because on my last record, I did a piece for The Guardian in the UK, which is a recreation of a childhood photo. It's me sitting in my bedroom in the 80s, MJ's on the wall, and I look happy and I look like a good little boy. And I tell the story behind that photo of just how sad I was, both at home and at school and all of those things. And, you know, I think my hope when I joined a band was I just thought we were going to be best friends. I thought that, oh man, you know, this is the guy that I'm going to write these songs with, and they are so magical. And I thought that that meant that we were just going to be like brothers. But I guess we were more, I'm not saying we're the Beatles, but I'm just saying, I guess our relationship was more like John and Paul. You know, there was this incredible magic when it came to the parts that we did together, but he had no interest even from the very beginning in being my friend. He saw himself as more of a Svengali. I would say, I think our band broke up because he probably thought he could just repeat that process. He probably didn't value my contribution to the band and probably overvalued his, whereas I've never done that. I've always gone, oh my God, that was lightning in a bottle. That was 50-50. That was two people, a once in a lifetime thing that happens very rarely. It's like love. Songwriting is like falling in love. And I think he was more interested in the success, whereas I could give a shit about that stuff. I never cared about that stuff. I was always interested in the magic, and that's why I've never stopped, really. Willie Williams gave me this incredible speech when the band ended, actually, and he sat me down and he said, "I'm going to save you 20 years of heartache. You're never going to be as successful as the band was, and you have to be okay with that now, so that every time you write a song and every time you do something, you can celebrate it like it's the first time you ever did it." And I did that. And I've always done that. And that's why I'm not bitter. I'm not someone that, you know, sits around saying, "Well, I could have been a contender." I just appreciate what happened to me and that I still get to do it if I choose to. And when I choose to, I still get to do it. Yeah.
I've always wondered, how does it feel for you to look at like a Troy Sivan or, you know, or Orville Peck or whatever? There's this generation of like out pop and, you know, all various, you know, genre stars.
Yeah, Sam Smith.
Sam Smith.
Anyone who just arrives born fully formed gay.
Yeah.
I feel grateful. I feel grateful that they don't have to suffer the way that I suffered. And I can't even imagine how generations beyond me suffered. I recently watched a documentary on Rock Hudson, you know, and that suffering, I can't even imagine what it must have been like to be gay in the 30s, 40s, or 50s. Oh my God. Yeah. You know, I know for me, this is a trigger warning about suicide, but I'm very public about this, but you know, my self-hatred of my own sexuality was so bad that, you know, I was suicidal over the fact that I was gay. And it's why I'm so vocal, I think, about equality and gay rights and, you know, trans visibility or whatever the latest sort of lightning rod for hatred is, I always make sure that I vocally support the voiceless, because first of all, those artists you mentioned make incredible music and they're free. And sometimes when people ask that question, I think they naturally would think, oh, do I feel jealous or envious or whatever? But I don't, you know, I know some of that pain that I experienced, it fueled a lot of creativity. There was a lot of hidden messages in my music. I remember being on the Jay Leno show and singing Affirmation. And I sang the line, I can't even believe I wrote this line and it got released actually back then. I believe you can't control or choose your sexuality. And I sang that on Jay Leno and winked at the camera. You know, and I have people that I meet today who will tell me that that moment is the reason they're alive. You know, they were a teenager in Ohio and they were thrown out of home. And then they saw a pop star say that and they knew that I was gay. And that just means everything to me. Yeah.
So when are we going to see this book on shelves?
I just submitted my first draft.
Okay.
Oh God, you can tell me more about this. What can I look forward to with notes from a publisher? They're coming back soon. It's supposed to come out in Australia in November.
Okay.
I just shot the front cover the other day.
Great.
Was your question, what can we expect or when can we expect?
Well, when?
Oh, and yeah. Well, before Christmas. Uh-huh. I can't imagine it's going to come out in the US until the next year, because I think it's one of those things where I have no shame in it. Most people are like, who's Daryl Haynes? I've never heard of that person. But I think the content of the book will surprise people, because it isn't a celebrity memoir. It really is, you know, it's about surviving trauma. It's about how all of those things we talked about, you know, it begins first person with me being about 5 years of age and thinking that I was telepathic because I could tell when my father was going to beat my mother up. And of course, now I know it's just that he was drunk and he was slurring his words and I didn't know what that meant. But, you know, from my very first memory, I was afraid. I was terrified. And I managed to create a persona and a career like most pop stars do, who have, you know, I think a huge traumatic event. I never realized that the people that I looked up to, you know, Madonna lost her mother. Michael Jackson had a horrific experience with his father. I had that same crushing force in my life, that the only way that I could survive was to become somebody else. And that's kind of what the book is about. Yeah.
Cannot wait to read it.
I can't wait. Do we have a title yet, or that has been announced?
I have a title. I can't tell you yet, but yeah, it's not exactly the most inspired. It's a bit of a bummer title, but hey, it's a happy ending. So, yeah,
great. We'll be there reading it the moment that it's available. Before we let you go, I have to ask, as we always do, about your romantic life. I know you're newly-ish single.
Mm-hmm.
How does that look and feel right now?
Oh God. Well, I'm a year out and it was hell. No one ever gets married thinking that they're going to get divorced. And gosh, the shortest possible answer I can tell you is I think I made myself very, very small for a long time. And I think that my absence from the public eye, my absence from the music industry, had a lot to do with that, because I was desperately trying to save my marriage. And I think that me releasing a record last year was, I liken it. I remember once I was in LA in Hollywood, which everyone knows downtown Hollywood is disgusting and not what you think it will be. Mm. But I remember seeing this weird growing through a crack in the pavement, and there was a flower in there, and realizing that life and beauty and hope is so resilient and will do anything it can do to be alive and to be seen. And even though I think at my darkest point, I didn't think I was going to make it, I think there was a deeper part of me, a younger part of me, that kid that was, you know, watching MTV as a child, that needed music and needed to come back to music in order to survive and probably save my life, I would say. So at first it was hell, and now I'm okay. And I don't think of marriage as like this priceless vase or vase in the Smithsonian that I broke. You know, I think of it as this continuum or this experience that I had that I'm proud of, and I did it for a very long time, and now it's gone. Yeah.
Finally, Darren Hayes, tell us a joke.
Oh God, I never have great jokes. I just have dad jokes. I make terrible dad jokes. Like, oh, okay. I can tell you, this is the truth, actually. Did you know the true story of Jolene?
Kind of.
It was, well, no, I don't think you did. It was originally a Levi's commercial. And it was called Low Jeans, Low Jeans, Low Jeans, Low Jeans. But it was rejected.
Wow. So I can't imagine why. Bad. I can't imagine why.
Dad jokes.
By the way, have you seen the old Levi's 501 jeans commercial with Stanley Tucci from like 1984?
Okay, well, Stanley Tucci from like 2024 is hot. So was he hot then?
Oh, nuts hot. Like crazy. But I'll send it to you.
Please do.
I will send it to the entire chain.
Stanley makes me lose control. Lose control.
Oh,
I can't wait.
Oh, boy. Yeah. Well, wow. Buckle up. Buckle up those Levi's 501 jeans, Darren Hayes.
I will. It's lovely to talk to you guys. Thank you for having me.
Oh, Renee's already put it in the chat. Renee's already put it in the chat so we can all.
She's on top of it.
Together. Oh, my God.
I'm going to share my screen.
Oh, my goodness. I'm going to need a cold beverage.
You have no fucking idea. Wait.
So he was a model?
No, he was just like a young actor. Here we go. There he is. Good fucking Lord.
That's crazy. He looks like
Here we go. Here he comes.
Can't handle it.
And now, first of all, everybody in this commercial is just automatically hot, but even the magician.
Wow.
God, I miss the 80s.
Barely a hair on his head, even then.
Oh.
Just.
Ooh,
that's amazing.
Goodness.
Good for you, Stanley.
Okay. I'm glad we had that moment. Woo.
Oh, my Lord.
Thank you
so
much.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, fellas.
That is our show. Please do give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts and follow us on Instagram at HomophiliaPod. Homophilia is a World of Wonder production, music by Ben Wise. Our executive producer is Renee Colvert. Our associate producer is Jess Walensky, and our audio engineer is Justin Mattson. Many thanks to Michael Pressman and everyone at World of Wonder.